Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
I caught up with returning Radio Gorgeous guest, Ayelet Gunder Goshen, on the occasion of the publication of her second novel, Waking Lions. We had previously spoken about her first novel, One Night Markovitch. Waking Lions is out now by Pushkin Press. I was as blown away by Waking Lions as I was by your first book, One Night Markovitch. Could you introduce us to the story of Waking Lions?
Waking Lions is the story of Dr. Eitan Green, and he thinks of himself as a good man. He's a doctor, he saves lives, he's a good family man, he's a good father. And then one night he finished an exhausting night shift in the hospital, and he drives home in his Jeep, and he hits an illegal refugee from Eritrea. And he decides to leave him there. And from this point, all his safe existence only really changes, because he doesn't know that the refugee's wife was there and that she's seen the accident. She knows what he did and she knows who he is. And then she starts blackmailing him.
And how he is even there, I mean, that is the sort of strike in the sand of a staff, you know, that everything reverberates out from. But there's things that have led him to that point that lead him to be driving in the desert where he was that night. And there are all the people, when it radiates out from there, there are all the people that one act affects.
Yeah, I like the idea that this clash of a car and a man is actually a clash of civilizations. I mean, the idea that this white man is driving in the desert in the middle of the night, and you have the refugee walking in the desert in the middle of the night, and you have the reason why his wife is there completely unseen, but there, and she notices. I like the idea that this one second when he hits him suddenly changed the life of everyone who was there and affects many other people that weren't there that night, but are directly affected by what he did or what he chose not to do. He chose not to call help.
Yeah. And I'm not going to gush too much, but I really, really enjoy reading your books. There's a continual surprise up to the last page. You know, there's so much information we get, but then we realize, oh, we hadn't gotten that piece before. One of the issues that it really just speaks to everywhere right now with the Syrian crisis and refugees from all over ending up everywhere, from the Middle East, from Africa, etc. One thing, you know, is that Eitan never really sees these refugees as people.
Yes, you're so right. And this is what was fascinating for me while writing Waking Lions, was the question, if he had hit a white man in the middle of the night, or a young woman from the near kibbutz in the middle of the night, I'm sure that he wouldn't be able to just leave him there. I think what enabled him to do it was the fact that this man was from Eritrea, that he looks completely different, that we in Israel don't look at these people as people, you know, with fears and dreams and feeling. We look at them as a problem, as a crisis, as the immigration issue. I mean, this is not just an issue. These are real people.
Yes, but we like to label them, you know. So they're terrorists, refugees, scroungers, you know, yeah. Criminals, whatever, you know. And as you say, problems, issues, and crises.
You can label something, you know. You can just put it in the drawer. You know, you put it in the place where you have the label, and you keep on going. Well, when it's a human being, you can't just keep on going when you see another human being suffering. And I think for a white doctor, you know, he votes left, he's very liberal, he thinks of himself as a good man. And if you ask him a night before, do you think that you'd be able to do such a thing? I think if you ask him, you know, in a cocktail party, then he'll say never, never. But when it finally happens, and he has to choose between going home to his wife and his kids, and between staying there next to this man who looks completely different, who speaks completely different language, who's from a different nation, he takes his choice.
It's also that assumed right of the white person. The assumption that his life is more important, that his life, that his ability to drive away, his ability to drive away, the luxury of being able to drive away is his right. Whereas, you know, these people are not, you know, considered to have rights, to have, you know, to have those, they're not afforded those luxuries, even in his mind. And even in, I would say, in our minds.
I completely agree with you. I think the right to zap between channels, I mean, the privilege to say, I had enough of the immigration crisis today. I can't see any more Syrian refugees. I'm switching off the television, or I'm just zapping to another channel. I think this is something that we, as white middle class European people, can very easily do. We can decide whether we want to see something or not to see it. And most of the time, we choose not to see it, unless, you know, we want to feel we're politically involved, and then we see it for 5 minutes in the papers, and that's it. But for the people who live this situation, this is not, you know, a label of the crisis. This is not a five-minute slot in the BBC News. This is their lives. And for me, what was fascinating to try to do literature about was to take the people you see in the news, always like casted as the victim, and to have them as the protagonist of the story, like the woman that saw him hitting her husband, and she blackmails him, and suddenly she's no longer the victim. Suddenly she gets to be this femme fatale with power. What happens when those people that we always not see suddenly see something that gives them the power over us?
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
I'm also drawn with, I mean, just in my own mind, the parallels with the Syrian refugees and the boats being turned away and the boats of Jews being turned away and the Exodus not, you know, being turned away from Palestine, which became Israel, and the damage we are doing now. And that we are so blind to it, and that we just, you know, we're just as blind.
I think it's fascinating. It's, you know, it's history's irony.
Say that again, I yell it. I love it.
I really think it is. I think it's history's irony that the same people, the same biblical people, the people of Israel, who walked that desert, this exact desert, the road from Sinai to Israel, it's the biblical road that the people of Israel walked when they tried to walk from Egypt to the promised land, a 40-year journey. And now we have people doing the exact same road, walking the same desert again, trying to reach the promised land. But this time, we're the gatekeepers. We're the one keeping them out.
Yeah. Well, and I always see that happening, you know, just even over a lifetime. You know, when we're young and idealistic and have nothing to lose, we're all communists and socialists and think everybody should share everything. And then when we have a little bit of something and we have children that we want that for, then all of a sudden we become, you know, we become more protective of this thing that we have and this idea of limited resources, and I want it for mine. And if I give you some, that's less for me and mine.
Exactly the zero-sum game which mm-hmm. we tend to think of. But actually, I mean, in Israel, this debate is always people saying, well, we can't have all of Africa coming to Israel. And of course, even me being very left-wing, I don't think we should have all of Africa coming here. But right now, Israel is giving the status of a refugee to less than 1% of the people arriving for Eritrea. So between 100%, which is all of Eritrea coming, and 1%, I mean, there's got to be more numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying we should accept everyone, but I think specifically us should be able to be more generous
yeah.
in a way.
Yes. And, you know, it also in a way is that, you know, it's a compliment. You know, you're doing well. You know, people want to come. And of course we can give more, especially, you know, here in England, if you think about the rationing that was 60 years ago, how little did we live on? And I'm not saying it was great and recommendable, but like you said, there's something in between here.
I think perhaps in a way it's because the fact that we really suffered starvation, that we didn't have anything, that the people who are now the citizens of Israel all come from times of when you want something and you don't have it. And then when you get it, then, you know, one could think you'd be more generous to people who have nothing. But maybe, you know, like this people who know starvation, that they try to keep a lot of food even
yeah.
afterwards.
Yeah.
They're always afraid of a catastrophe behind the corner.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why we shut the doors.
Well, because we know what it's like not to have it, and it's I guess it's too risky. It appears too risky. Although
yeah.
I think the repercussions will be far worse than the repercussions of sharing.
Exactly. I just believe that Israel is right now strong enough to accept, once again, not all of the refugees, obviously, but more than 1%.
Mm.
I mean, think about it. We are a nation of refugees. We know what it's like to walk the desert. I mean, I can't believe that right now my country is doing that to other people.
Well, I've long said the same thing about America. Like, nobody's, you know, other than the Native Americans that we killed, none of us. So, and they're like, oh yeah, well, we were fine, but no more, you know?
Sort of the full bus effect. I don't know if you take public transport, but when you wait for the bus to come and it comes and it's quite packed, you beg for the driver to stop because, I mean, people have been waiting here for ages. Please let me go on the bus. But the moment you're on the bus and the bus is so packed and you just want to get off, and then he wants to stop in the next station and you shout on the driver, no way, because it's too packed. So the question is, are you on the bus or are you out?
RadioGorgeous.com.
And it's all a matter of luck and not birthright. And that idea that it's luck seems to have been lost somewhere. And I think you, getting back to your writing, are redressing that fact. There's a voice in your writing that's sort of like a joyful rabbi in the fact that it's this questioning voice, and it's this all-seeing questioning voice. And it doesn't stop at the polite places, and it doesn't stop at the convenient places, and it doesn't stop. And it doesn't stop. It looks at you as much as it looks at me. It looks at, you know what I mean? It's that voice doesn't stop.
First of all, I love the idea of a cheerful rabbi. I think if you want to write polite, then you better not write. I mean, it's always easier to look at other people and to judge them, but I think literature is always more interesting when you dare to look at yourself, at your own culture, at your own society, with eyes really wide open, and to look at the places that we usually don't look at. It's like, I'm also a psychologist, and when somebody comes and says something like, I had this dream that I don't want to tell anybody, I think this dream is more important than, you know, his whole daily routine, because maybe the routine really happened and the dream is a fantasy. But if it's a fantasy that you don't want to look at, then it has a whole lot of truth in it.
Hmm. I was listening to a radio show recently on the BBC, and your name came up. And it was a woman talking about writing in Israel now and how it's very difficult to fight against a prevailing wind. And the prevailing wind, the prevailing political wind, fueled by fear, is that Israel is in a vulnerable position and we need to clamp down and hit back harder and, you know, this ultra-conservativism, and that is sneaking into people's writing. People are self-censoring, publishers are censoring, and, you know, sort of critical work, of which you were considered one of the few that is not doing this. But is that something that you are aware of, both that work is sort of being self-censored, and that you are recognized as being out of that?
I think the most disturbing thing is about the writer that never published anything before and is right now trying to write his first novel. And will he or she feel safe enough to write what they really want, or will they be afraid by the fact that literature prizes and many of the publishing houses are right now, I don't think the publishing houses are right-wing, but I think the atmosphere in Israel right now is very dichotomic. It's like, are you with us or against us?
Yep.
And I don't like this idea. I think that there are more point of views than yes and no. I mean, I think one can love his country and be very critical of it. Like, you can really love your parents and be very critical of them. I mean, it's not something that's coming because you don't like your country. It's something that comes because you love it enough to fight it when it does something wrong.
Exactly, which is why we correct and discipline our children. You know, we love them and we want them to be the best than they can be, and we know that spoiling them and just letting them do what they want to do isn't the right thing to do. It isn't the best thing to do.
Exactly, but I sometimes feel, I felt it after my trip to London, that both inside in Israel, but also outside, when people talk about Israel, they talk about like it's a football match, you know? Mm. And there's one team who's the ultimate good, and there's one team who's the ultimate evil. And, you know, life is more complicated than a football match.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the Palestinians are the ultimate evil. I think this is my job to talk against this concept in Israel. And sometimes when I go outside of Israel, I feel uncomfortable with the alternative of Israel being the ultimate evil.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's ultimate evil. I think there's people being afraid and doing bad things. And this is something we should stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because it's just, you know, generations, you know, this litany of generations and generations. And, you know, it is a very real thing that Israel is under threat, and fear makes people do really stupid, bad things. You know, it's just insolvable. However,
I mean, my little girl was born right before the Gaza war, and I remember that I was breastfeeding her while there was the alarms. And you had to stop feeding her and go down because people were afraid of missiles. And I remember I thought, right now there's a Palestinian mother in Gaza which suffered, you know, so many losses. We're just afraid of the alarms. But, I mean, hundreds were dead there. And I thought, right now there's a Palestinian mother in Gaza, and my people are bombing this mother while her people are, you know, it's...
Yeah.
I think it's a catastrophe. I think this is something that must be stopped.
Yeah. And it can only be stopped when people read your books and remember that they're people, and that we are people, and that, you know, our commonality is more important than, you know, than our differences.
I very much agree. I mean, I think literature is a sneaky thing to do, because it's not like a political petition. I mean, you don't write a novel just to, you know, have a political message, because that's when you just go out and demonstrate. You don't write 400 pages of, you know, morality issues, because it would be boring. But in a way, it's tricky, because I think the best literature I read is the one that, through a specific story, which is always like interesting and you have a lot of tense during it, but in the end, it's about people, being people.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
And it's always, what's lovely is that it's, it is always left to us to decide how, and you know, how we are going to live, and if we are going to live thinking, or if we're going to live, you know, buried in the sand. That is left to us.
I just thought about what you said, that it's very true about the journey of Eitan after he hits the Eritrean, because he has this question of, do you really want to go on with your life knowing that you killed that man and just, you know, go on because you can, because you're white and a doctor? Or will you, for once in your life, choose to do something differently? Mm. Even if she's not blackmailing you, for instance, anymore, this woman, like, what would you choose to do? And I really hope that the readers will ask themselves, I think, the same question. If it happened to you in the middle of the night, ran over some refugee that nobody knows, that's not registered anywhere, and nobody else knows, would you stop or would you keep on going?
Mm-hmm. And especially for Eitan, it's a particularly poignant question. Because he'd recently, you know, faced a question of, you know, that was he felt was the big moral question in his life, and yet, as life often does, it throws him, you know, an even bigger one, a test of his moral mettle. I highly recommend this book. Ayelet, what else do you like to talk about this book?
You want to talk about Sirkit?
Yes.
Let's talk about Sirkit. She was really important to me, this woman. Because at first I thought it would only be his story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story of a man doing a hit and run. And then the idea that there was this woman that saw it and suddenly gains power. And that the minute she has power, she can, you know, she can lust, like she mm-hmm. can dream once again.
Mm-hmm.
I really miss her after I finished writing the novel.
Yeah, she was. I also loved the way her story was revealed to us, sort of over time, because our assumptions were Eitan's assumptions. And what we saw of her at first was what he saw of her. You know, we saw her through his eyes. And then, of course, the happy rabbi comes around and pokes around in corners and reveals her story. And everything, you know, and as waves of hers cascade out, things become more and more complicated. You know, and that's, you know, the murky colors, the murkiness of life it's always there. Nothing is ever black and white. And she was such an interesting character, and it was such a pleasure to get to know her choices, which again, you know, were probably different from other people's choices, and possibly different from what we would think they would be. Did you have any issues writing about an Eritrean refugee? Did you think, oh, you know, am I allowed to do that? Do I have a right to do that?
My editor at first told me, this is too much. You're not going to try and write a black refugee woman that walked from Eritrea to Israel because this is too much for you. And I thought, in a way, this is dehumanizing to think that we can't get inside the head of a black woman.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that you'd say about an animal. I can't imagine the world through the eyes of a fly.
Yeah.
This is not a fly, it's a woman. And I think the humanistic point of view is that people are people, and that you should try and try again and fail and try again and fail and try again to be able to look at the eyes. The world through the eyes of people different from you.
That's interesting, because even you know, because I guess that's another label we use to, again, distance ourselves, you know, from her story. You couldn't possibly imagine, you know, and it would be rude of you to try. Is just another way that we use to distance ourselves from her, and, you know, and from refugees, from her story. Interesting.
I completely agree. I think that You know, my grandparents were refugees. Of course, I grew up in Tel Aviv. I know nothing of this experience. And I should be humble when I try to write about something that I never experienced. But to be humble about it doesn't mean to avoid it. I think the moment you avoid something, once again, this is the moment that you're doing a sort of dehumanization, because you're saying this is not a human experience that human can imagine. And I think it would be like committing a sin against her not to write her from the inside, but to only write her from his perspective, you know, from the white man's point of view. I wanted her to have her own life, her own choices, her own fantasies. I wanted her to be capable of being a bitch at certain points of the novel. I think if, you know, being like this bad woman or being a bitch and not being all the time this really brave, noble, silent victim, this is also part of being a full human being. Have all these different aspects in your personality.
Yes. Yes, because you know, being a refugee is a status. It's not a personality trait. You know, we seem to, you know, sort of swap them out.
It's a way to put it. But,
so does this sort of searching, unflinching, uncompromising view for honesty, does this affect you in your relationships, in your mothering? Or do you confine it to the page?
I think I'm much more brave when I'm writing than I am in the real world, which is good because it keeps my relationships going in the real world. If you write, then you really should never lie. But when I get a present that I really don't want, I still give a big hug and say, thanks, that's amazing.
Well, I know whatever I give you when I meet you in Edinburgh, I'll get a hug and you'll tell me it's amazing. In that way, you're very easy to buy presents for.
Definitely.
Oh. I'll ask you what you're working on now, if I may.
I'm working on my third novel. I'm experiencing motherhood and writing as very difficult together. So I think it takes longer this time. But then again, the reason is a really good reason. You're really competing. I mean, you put all your love and your efforts into, you know, this little girl who's, you know, alive and talking, and it's crazy. And then you have those people inside your head which you also want to be alive and talking. But
exactly.
You only need time and energy and love.
Yes. Well, good luck with all of that, with that wonderful juggling dance. And thank you so much. I look forward to whenever your third novel comes.
Shalom.
Okay.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I? Worry. crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. Crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.